Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are celebrating Sonoma State University's Social Justice Week. We're featuring today a keynote speech given by independent journalist Abby Martin of Media Roots and the Empire Files. Abby Martin also penned the foreword for Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. Her talk from February 27, as part of Social Justice Week, was titled Critical Media Challenging U.S. Empire. Abby Martin talks about the state of media and propaganda, particularly regarding the events unfolding in Venezuela. On the Project Censored Show today, a special episode with Abby Martin. Stay with us.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back Abby Martin of Media Roots and, of course, the Empire Files. Abby Martin also penned the foreword for Censored 2019, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. That's our latest book. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. She was recently part of Sonoma State University's Social Justice Week. And Sonoma State University in Northern California is where Project Censored was founded by Carl Jensen in 1976. Since then, Peter Phillips, who ran the project for many, many years until I became director in 2010, has now been, for the last several years, putting together an entire week dedicated to social justice issues. On today's program, we're sharing with you one of the talks from this year's Sonoma State Social Justice Lecture Series. Abby Martin was the keynote speaker and gave a talk on critical media challenging U.S. empire, where she talks at great length about the propaganda surrounding U.S. involvement in Venezuela. We now share that talk with you.
Now I'd like to introduce Abby Martin. She is an anti-imperialist journalist, founder of Media Roots, former member of the board of directors at the Media Freedom Foundation, Project Censored, and the creator of the Empire Files. Please give her a round of applause.
What's up, you guys? Thanks for coming out tonight and supporting this important event and Social Justice Week and for supporting Project Censored. It's an incredibly important organization. It's how I actually got my start in media. I saw Peter Phillips speak, and I realized that if you're not getting involved in becoming the media, then you can't get your issue out. It doesn't matter what your issue is. Mine happened to be war, imperialism, and empire. And that's just what generated me to do what I'm doing today. So thank you so much again. It's an incredible honor to be here. My name is Abby Martin. I am the creator of a show called The Empire Files, which used to be on a Latin American network called Telesur. It's a conglomerate of Latin American states. Unfortunately, the show got shut down because of U.S. sanctions against Venezuela in the past year. So we had to go independent. And in the abysmal state of media, I think that's just the route that a lot of us are going now, where we're funded by donors and we're really just grassroots from the people's perspective from the ground up. So what we do at Empire Files is we analyze issues using the U.S. empire as a starting point, because I think every issue is really rooted in the heart of the empire. Here we are in the heart of the empire. We try to reclaim these narratives that have been set by the colonizers, imperialists around the world, right? How have these regions been shaped by empire? And every domestic issue we try to analyze through the understanding of U.S. empire as well. How are all of our resources squandered from the U.S. empire, from military spending? Why can't we afford health care when every other country in the world pretty much has that for their people? And we're spending more than the next 12 countries combined on our military spending. There's too many bases that the Pentagon doesn't even know how many bases that there are. There's things called lily pad bases that they can't even account for. So I think the number right now that we know is 800 military bases around the world. It's the largest empire the world's ever seen. And you don't hear about this on corporate media. You don't even hear the word empire being used. People think I'm talking about Star Wars when I explain what this government is doing around the world. It's pretty fascinating, kind of the historical amnesia and ignorance from the American public about what their government is doing around the world. I mean, just the interventions alone, usurping the democratic processes of countless countries. Looking at Latin America alone, the number is near 60. And I'm going to focus my talk tonight on, of course, the ongoing coup and how the media is really becoming just a completely subservient to the ruling class and painting the propaganda framework for that coup. You know, none of these things are allowed in the corporate media. The corporate media frames and limits the parameters of debate, a very lively debate within those very select parameters, of course. But you just don't hear about these things, right? You don't hear about the fact that half of this country is living paycheck to paycheck. You don't hear our politicians even talk about poor people here. So it's a dire state, right? And I think it's as time goes on and as corporations become stronger and more consolidated, we're just seeing less and less media space for alternative outlets to really have a voice and to provide that clear perspective that's so crucial and so needed. So I was going to talk just generally about, you know, how the corporate media serves empire, and we're just in the middle of one of the most egregious coup attempts in modern history, kind of coup by tweet in the social media sphere. And I think it's really important to focus on how the media is specifically manufacturing consent for war in Venezuela and use it as a case study for fake news, which Trump has kind of hijacked as his own term. And I think understanding the media line in Venezuela can help us understand more about how the corporate media functions, how it's an essential instrument for the U.S. war machine and its proxies around the world. I woke up to corporate media censorship during the Iraq War. The propaganda was all intensive, it was wall to wall, and it was all consuming. But there still was this lingering fear of terrorism. There was still kind of the periphery, that deep-seated fear. You know, 9/11 was still fresh. It was only a year and change previously that 9/11 had happened. This makes much less sense to me. Venezuela poses zero threat to the U.S., but for some reason, we've kind of all bought into this notion that we're a benign force that tries to help people, even if it's led by Donald Trump in this kind of humanitarian mission. So it's just as uniform, though. Even though the propaganda doesn't stick as well as it did maybe during the Iraq War, it's just as blatant, perhaps even more so. You know, and compare, just really quickly, compare the coverage of Venezuela to Gaza, an actual dire humanitarian crisis, 2 million people caged in, 95% unpotable water. They don't have electricity. How is that not a humanitarian crisis? Are we now talking about invading Gaza to save and liberate the people there? So you really have to ask yourself when you're hearing these tropes, like, what does that actually mean, this humanitarian crisis, this notion that these people need to be saved by Western intervention? Look at Yemen. This is a humanitarian crisis that's the gravest in the entire world. We have tens of millions on the brink of actually starving to death, and that is being facilitated by the U.S. empire. So it's grotesque. The hypocrisy is grotesque. And, you know, it's so strange to me that the corporate media has this kind of faux dissent against Trump's domestic policies, but they've lined up to support this coup. And every time there's issues of war and peace, every time we're talking about militarism or expansion of empire, that's when the corporate media really comes out in full force to fight Trump from the right. You can look at withdrawing from the nuclear treaty that they called him weak for, that's setting us on the path of nuclear war with Russia. That he's weak for doing that. Or you can look at the fact that they were hammering him for talking about removing troops from Korea. Somehow they're arguing that we still need troops in Korea. So they were fighting him from the right on that. And then look at Syria, right? That was when he became president. That was when Trump became president, when he bombed Assad. So it's pretty astounding, isn't it? And every media outlet across the board paints the same picture about Venezuela. It's a starving nation. People are eating zoo animals, rats, and their pets, right? It's a brutal dictatorship where protesters are getting arbitrarily gunned down in the streets. And there's no democracy, and that's why this guy Juan Guaido is reclaiming democracy. This is a democratic measure to reinstate democracy in the country. But before we go further into these points, let's look at who, again, who is leading this coup attempt? Donald Trump, reality star billionaire, xenophobe who calls Africa a shithole, implemented a Muslim ban, the most bigoted, misogynist, racist, who's carpet bombing the Middle East. This is the man that Democrats in the media called unstable, potentially the next Hitler. Yet they're lining up to support his quote-unquote humanitarianism in Venezuela. Mike Pompeo, he's an apocalyptic madman who thinks the rapture is nigh. This is a guy who just went on Fox News and declared Hezbollah is in Venezuela. Iranian cells are in Venezuela. And what did Fox News do as a response? They just printed it. Confirmed. Confirmed. Well, Mike Pompeo said it. Well, that's confirmed. Hezbollah in Iran, in Venezuela. And then you have John Bolton. This is an Iraq war architect. Extremely dangerous neocon. He declared, with zero evidence, that Russia and Cuba were arbitrarily executing people on the street in Venezuela right now, like cells, you know, these agents from these hostile nations. Just stunning bullshit. And then, of course, we know that the troika of tyranny, where this is not just about Venezuela, this is about Cuba and Nicaragua and completely reshaping and recolonizing Latin America at the behest of U.S. corporations and militarism. And then I think the most comical person involved in this is Elliot Abrams. He led the 2002 coup against Hugo Chavez with the Bush administration. He is a literal war criminal, and I'm not mincing words. He literally is a war criminal. He hid weapons and aid shipments during the Iran-Contra scandal. He facilitated genocide. He funded right-wing death squads. I mean, it's cartoonishly brazen to have this guy back in office overseeing the current coup instead of being chained to a dungeon wall for eternity, which is where he should be. You'd think that Donald Trump leading this gaggle of war criminals would be a cause for concern for people. People would maybe question the notion that, maybe this isn't about humanitarianism at all. But no, the corporate media is lined up, as well as Democratic progressive darlings in the administration, to basically support the propaganda framework again. So even though you see Bernie Sanders saying that he opposes military intervention, he's still saying Maduro needs to let the aid in. The aid is a mechanism for regime change. That's the second stage of the coup. So it's very disconcerting to see even the most progressive people in Congress buying into the propaganda and actually helping the coup be facilitated. It's a disgrace, frankly. So let's look at the media's promotion of the coup and the major justifications for the coup. Dictatorship versus democracy. Maduro's a dictator, right? Juan Guaido is the president. He's the interim president, and he's saving democracy. Well, what's weird about this, I think the weirdest part, is that the opposition making this claim won their seats through the same electoral process that Maduro won. So I guess the elections are only rigged when the socialists win, not when they win seats. So that's always just been kind of a funny thing. I mean, Venezuelan elections have more checks and balances than most countries in the world. As a matter of fact, they're certainly more democratic than our elections. They are heavily monitored by independent observers. And in fact, the opposition called the UN to not come and observe the elections in 2018, which could have proved alleged voter fraud if they actually came. So that's very fascinating. They did not want the UN there to observe the results because, of course, the opposition wants to declare these elections illegitimate so it can bolster the claim that Maduro is a dictator and the elections are fake. So they boycotted the process. They boycotted the process. They refused to run. They refused to vote. And one of the opposition coalition members, Henry Falcone, actually disrupted that plan. He did put his voice in the ring, and he immediately got expelled by the MUD coalition in Venezuela and threatened to be sanctioned by the U.S. government. Literally threatened by Mike Pence and Donald Trump for running an election. That's really amazing. So they are too fragmented. I mean, the opposition's too fragmented to win. That's why Maduro won, right? And they can't kind of galvanize themselves to win, so they keep trying to usurp and reclaim power by violent, undemocratic means. And it's pretty scary because not only are they boycotting the elections, but there's armed, kind of violent wings of the opposition that go and actually attack and intimidate voters and attack polling places. And in the last election, there were 200 polling places that were attacked, 10 deaths. So there was a lot of intimidation on the ground to try to prevent this process from going through. But at the end of the day, Maduro won. He won with 6.2 million votes, and he trounced the next person in line, which was Henry Falcone. He actually won with the same percentile that Barack Obama did in eligible voters. We're talking about 6.2 million votes in a country of 30 million with 20 million eligible voters. That's a lot. That's a lot given the economic crisis that exists. Given the pressure on the country. It is difficult to live in a country that's under siege by the U.S. empire. That is why people are leaving. That is why people still leave Cuba. It's not easy to live under economic embargo, of crippling sanctions preventing crucial medicine from reaching you. That's difficult. So there are many leftist progressive socialists within the opposition. It's kind of unfair to paint the opposition with this broad brush and claim that they're all violent, they're all far right. But the opposition wing that is trying to take power right now is the far right. The second that Juan Guaido declared himself president, he immediately tried to not only expel CITGO's board, the state oil company, he tried to immediately pass a new hydrocarbons law, mass privatize the oil, which is odd. Because I thought this was like a starving nation that you wanted to go in and save, and immediately you're just doing legislation to privatize the oil. It seems like a weird set of priorities if you're really trying to go in there and save the day. Who is this guy? He's a 35-year-old man who's much more well-known in the elite circles of Washington, D.C. than he is in his home country. 80% of Venezuelans had no idea who the hell this guy was before he appointed himself king. He studied under an IMF director at George Washington. And him and his mentor, Leopoldo Lopez, in the country were heavily backed by U.S. regime change fronts, the National Endowment for Democracy, and USAID. By 2010, international agencies such as these were pouring $50 million a year, $50 million a year into funding the opposition movement in Venezuela. Think about how much money that is. Think about how far-reaching that can go. So this is what the CIA does now. They use these non-governmental organizations to foment the discord and the radical discontent that they blame people like me doing in this country, that they're paying Venezuelans to do to try to overthrow their government and to create that quote-unquote humanitarian crisis, which I'm going to get into. So, you know, the day before this happened, no one was involved in this. There was only like three other people in Venezuela who even knew about the plan and that were working with Guaido to do this. So it was kind of a surprise to a lot of opposition people as well that he even declared himself president without really their backing. But he got the green light from Mike Pence, and that's pretty much all he needed. The day before the coup, he got a call from Mike Pence and said, "We're with you, go ahead." As the White House explained to the Washington Post, quote, "We've been engaged with the same strategy in Venezuela, to build international pressure, to help organize the internal opposition, and push for a peaceful restoration of democracy. But that internal piece was missing. Guaido was the piece we needed for our strategy to be coherent and complete." Well, sounds like a pretty open and shut case of regime change CIA plot. Like, we can all go home now. I mean, how ridiculous, how brazen is this? That they're actually just telling the media, yeah, Guaido was exactly what we needed to make this complete, to get our coup off the ground. But again, you're not hearing any of this on the media, right? The media that allegedly hates Trump, the fake news that's trying to take him down. And let's talk about this notion of an international community, this kind of coalition of the willing. That's what we heard during the Iraq War, remember? How many nations supported the U.S. in their invasion of Iraq? Well, you hear the same thing today, that the international community supports Juan Guaido. Well, oddly enough, when you look at what that international community is actually comprised of, it's mostly just white colonizer imperialist nations or former empires that support Juan Guaido or U.S. allied Latin American countries. Africa, every single country in Africa except Morocco does not recognize Guaido. Every single country in the Middle East except for Israel does not recognize Guaido. Every single country in the Caribbean except for the Bahamas does not recognize Guaido. And it just goes on and on and on. And so it's just quite disgusting to actually have those voices erased. To not talk about the brown, black populations of the world and what they think about this coup. So I've always just been really disgusted by that. So let's go on to the next kind of talking point here, which is validating our intervention here, which is Maduro's security forces are crushing dissent and wantonly executing peaceful protesters on the ground. Well, that couldn't be further from the truth. There are huge anti-government protests that stretch as far as the eye can see, hundreds of thousands of people filling up giant square blocks, right? We've all seen that with our own eyes. Zero government interference. I was there, we've seen it. I don't think any of us can really claim that we've seen those protests be interfered with by the government. Now, there's another side of the story here where there are armed kind of blockaded wings of the protests called guarimbas. They are violent. They are armed with Molotov cocktails, grenades, and bombs, and they do create a lot of violence. They burn down food distribution warehouses, they invade maternity clinics, they're attacking schools, hospitals, pretty much anything that can represent the Socialist Party and represents an enclave of the state, they will attack it. The second that they found out that I was working with Telesur on the ground, they threatened to lynch and assassinate me, and I had to flee the country. This is what they do. They consider Telesur an enemy, part of the enemy, because it's affiliated with the state, and there's been multiple coup plots that have been uncovered that actually had Telesur as a target to be firebombed and taken out if those coups did indeed go through. So Telesur will, in fact, be targeted if Juan Guaido and the coup does succeed here. And it already has been targeted, of course, by the sanctions that we don't really hear about.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're listening to a speech given by independent journalist Abby Martin at Sonoma State University's Social Justice Week. This was in February, on February 27th, earlier this year. The title of the talk, Critical Media, Challenging U.S. Empire, where Abby Martin talks in detail about the propaganda surrounding U.S. involvement in Venezuela. Special thanks to John Bertucci for the recording. After this break, we'll hear more from Abby Martin. Stay with us.
Telling the truth, exposing the lies. Think about the bad soldiers when you're driving your ride. The people die for the war, and Daddy Bush's revenge. I'm with the widows, the children, and the lonely best friends. I'm for families staying together as one. I'm not for the raids and the deportations. I'm with Victor Toro and the MIR. So watch out for them snitches in the unmarked car.
So I was there, you know, I saw with my own eyes these protesters basically commandeering giant 16-wheeler trucks, pulling people out, burning them, setting up these huge street blockades. And that's pretty much where the majority of the deaths are. Whenever you see these statistics, you know, 140 protesters dead, they make it seem like Maduro's going around and ordering the death of these people, which is also interesting because when cops kill people here, do we say Obama's thugs went out and shot protesters? Like, no, you don't affiliate what the police are doing with like direct orders from Trump or Obama. So that's bizarre already, right? Like the talking point doesn't make sense, but it also is just false. First of all, Caracas is the most crime-ridden city in the entire world, so a lot of does happen, and there is a lot of violence. It's very dangerous, and that is hand-in-hand with just the economic crisis. Inflation is sky-high, it's, you know, shortages of food, it's a difficult place to live, and so there is a lot of crime. And so these people kind of use the protests and carry out a lot of violent activity under the cover of kind of protesting, right? And I interviewed these people because a lot of these people are just glorified. I mean, everyone from Vice to MSNBC can go and embed themselves with the Guarimbas, and they're all like masked and, you know, making Molotov cocktail factories, and they just like pretend like this is necessary because these people are pushed to desperation enough that, yeah, they're gonna throw Molotov cocktails at the cops when they're going through this, right? But none of these people actually talk to them. They just put a microphone like, why are you throwing Molotov cocktails? Why do you have a grenade in your hand? And I spoke to one of these people who actually was holding a grenade, and he said, I can't be an entrepreneur. Think about that. I said, why are you holding a grenade? He said, I cannot be a business owner here. So that's kind of the mentality. It is a class struggle. It's very, very kind of viscerally, like there's a very visceral racial dynamic of the opposition. It's a lot more white, affluent. It's the revolt of the well-off. And when you look at kind of the history and legacy of Hugo Chavez and subsequently Maduro, you understand that they are black, Afro-Indigenous Venezuelans who have uplifted millions of people out of poverty that were rendered invisible by the same class that wants to take back that power. So I wanted to just say one more thing about this notion that Maduro's killing people in the streets, and I wanted to use a media example to show you just how this works in the framework of the corporate media. CBS News, January 22nd to January 25th of this year, as the coup was really exploding, 40 people died, 40 people were killed. Now, if you're watching the corporate media, you would take away that Maduro ordered police forces to go and just assassinate protesters, just arbitrarily, right? What's amazing is when you look at this, oh, and CBS actually did say, they literally came out and said, quote, after last week's mass unrest, when security forces killed more than 40 people, that was a CBS quote. Now, amazingly, it's such a bold lie that they actually contradicted themselves in another article where they said, the UN believes 40 died in different manners, including 12 killed by incidents related to looting. I was like, wait. Okay, so that's different. First, you said 40 people were straight up killed by police on the orders of Maduro, and now the story is changing to 40 people died. We don't know how. Could be crime, could be looting. Weird, right? So then I looked at the actual UN report, because of course, again, they're claiming that like either Maduro security forces or pro-government gangs go and like wantonly kill people in the streets. So when you looked at the actual UN report, it said it could have been armed gangs, either pro-government or otherwise. I was like, well, that's fraud as hell. So it could have been anyone, basically. Like, I mean, it's just so disingenuous when you really try to dig further than the headline, and even dig further than that, like actually see the reports that these people reference. And even if the UN did say, we got reports that, you know, these many people died by pro-government gangs, I mean, a lot of these sources, not only being fed to the corporate media, but also these non-governmental organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch are being fed by opposition people. The Chavistas are ignored. Opposition people, again, they are much more well-connected. They have a direct kind of line to the non-governmental organizations. They directly work with the U.S. government. So, of course, they're going to be way more presented in the corporate media. That's just like by default of their presence, right? And I've talked to several Chavistas who will die for the Bolivarian Revolution. They'll die for Maduro. And they told me, we don't exist on the corporate media. They said, revolutionaries don't exist. And thank you for telling our story, because there are millions of us. And again, there are millions and millions of people who believe in this movement. It's not necessarily about Maduro. He is a surrogate for the Bolivarian Revolution that Hugo Chavez started, and that Maduro is simply carrying on. And they believe in that process. They believe in that process, and that's why they voted to continue that process last year. So it's pretty disgusting. Again, I hate to keep calling out Bernie Sanders and others who are basically saying that the last election was undemocratic and calling for new elections. They just had elections. They just had elections. So again, you're playing into this kind of propaganda where you're saying, oh, they need to do this. No, they don't need to do anything at the behest of you. They're a sovereign country. They have their own constitution. So stop telling people what they should do and bending the empire and its military to bend these other countries to your will. It's grotesque. It is absolutely grotesque. So now let's look at the final notion that this is a humanitarian crisis, right? That's what we're told. With authority from pretty much everyone across the board, that there's a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela, and that's why we need to intervene. What's surprisingly absent from this discourse is testimony from the actual UN human rights investigator that was designated to investigate the said humanitarian crisis. His name is Alfred De Zayas. He was the first UN investigator to go to Venezuela in 21 years. I interviewed him on Empire Files. It's an incredible interview. I mean, he's been ignored by every single mainstream news outlet. He has written 21 reports for the Human Rights Council, and he wrote the definitive report on Venezuela. And the findings are astounding, because it really just flies in the face of everything that you're being fed by the mainstream media apparatus. Not only does he outline how this coup is just a brazen violation of international law, but he also talks about how the sanctions and the economic embargo that were implemented by first the Obama administration in 2013, and then the Trump administration, which really has ramped it up to a completely unseen level, where he put, I think, 70 new sanctions on Venezuela, of course, before the coup even happened. But that is what has really stifled and asphyxiated Venezuela's economy and really prevented it from recovering. Of course, you can't uncouple the economic crisis with the price of oil. I mean, Venezuela is a country that is 95% or even more dependent on oil exports for its revenue. And oil took a free fall a couple years ago, and their economy just completely went into free fall at that point. And here's the difference, is that obviously a country as rich as Venezuela and as resource-rich as Venezuela would be able to pick itself up by its feet if anything like that happens. The thing is, because of the economic embargo that was implemented, you have to trade oil in US dollars, so that was impossible. They couldn't absolve their debt. They couldn't take out loans. All of those things were stifled for them. And not only that, but other countries that they may do deals with were then threatened with sanctions if they did help Venezuela. So how were they supposed to recover economically? That's just the prevention of recovery, right? And then you look at kind of the genocidal nature of what sanctions are. Sanctions are war. Look no further than the 500,000 babies that died from dysentery-related illnesses during the Iraq, build-up to the Iraq War, right, the first Gulf War. Madeleine Albright said that was worth it. That's what these people think. 500,000 kids is worth it for them to expand their hegemony around the world. That's sick. Sorry, I get really upset because it's just insane to me that this is happening again and we're just going along with it. But these sanctions are genocidal. Alfred de Zayas talked to me about what the sanctions have actually done, and it's pretty stunning. In 2018 alone, 300,000 doses of insulin were prevented from being delivered to Venezuelans. Tell me if you know any diabetics who can survive without insulin. $1.65 billion blocked for the payment of food and medicine. $7 million for dialysis treatment for children. That's the nature of these sanctions. They're not for corrupt government officials. They are affecting and hurting the most poor, vulnerable Venezuelans that are then being used as a cynical talking point, as a precursor to invade and to military intervene. I mean, it's really cynical. And when you start to kind of realize this egregious inhumanity and immorality of the economic war, you realize how fake the notion that we care about humanitarianism in this country. Let's just talk really quickly about what happened last weekend. There was this insane escalation at the border. Of course, you know, the coup has been attempted for the last month. It has been failing. The resilience of the Venezuelan people is profound. Again, they've been trying to overthrow this government since the election of Hugo Chavez, and they have failed dozens of times. Think about how crazy that is, pouring $50 million a year to try to create this revolution within the country. Imagine how much money, like if Project Censored were given $50 million, imagine what we could do with that. I mean, it's just crazy that that shows you how strong the people are. I mean, the resilience of the people is just unbelievable. The fact they have resisted this effort, and they've resisted this latest effort as well, despite, again, the fact that a lot of people are upset. The economic war is very real. Anyone who's honest about Venezuela will tell you, yeah, it's not that there's a mass shortage of food. There's shortage of particular food items, flour, toilet paper, toothpaste, butter, things that are very crucial to make daily things for Venezuelans. So yeah, it is hard. People are leaving, but it's the people who can afford to leave. And so again, they're using the people who support Maduro, which is the poor masses, as the reason, as their tool for this entire regime change mantra. Now, what happened at the border was stunning. And we're talking about tech giants too. I mean, I saw every hour there was another Twitter moment where it was like, what happened at the border? And so you have Marco Rubio alongside the Latin American allies, you know, Ivan Duque, the president of Colombia, he's another proto-fascist, who's with Marco Rubio at the border with Juan Guaido, their little puppet, staging this concert with Richard Branson. Like, what in the hell was that? That was nuts, right? But here they are. Here they are at the border. By the way, the bridge on the border that they were trying to say that they were going to let this aid in was like an unused bridge that hadn't even been finished built yet. But the media was just circulating it saying, look at how crazy this dictator is preventing his aid from coming in on this bridge. It's like, well, first of all, this is a hoax. The bridge isn't even in effect. So why are you doing this? But also, all right, let's talk about what happened at the bridge over the weekend. They lined up all of these USAID trucks. By the way, the Red Cross will have nothing to do with this. They call it a political stunt and a faux kind of attempt for regime change. Now, that's pretty crazy because we know the Red Cross is not like a radical organization here. I think if the Red Cross is not wanting to not to do something, you should probably take heed of that. So Marco Rubio, his little fascist cabal at the border, just trying to foment this like hysterical crisis, right? They tried several things. First of all, you have John Bolton trying to encourage defectors from Maduro's army. He's like, he's literally trying to bribe them. He's like, we will give you money. We will not sanction you. Please leave the army and defect. So the first thing that happened on Saturday, I think it was, because they gave him a deadline. He was like, if you don't let the aid in by Saturday, then like, we're gonna make it come in whether you like it or not. So it was like clear, blatant threats of a war escalation. Then you have, you know, U.S. militaries built up in Puerto Rico and other staging grounds to basically just openly threaten Maduro. So three armored vehicles just charged full force at the aid barricade into groups of civilians. And they had to like dive out of the way. Those people were hailed as heroes in the media. The Colombian Border Patrol immediately took them in and said, you're ours, and immediately protected them. What's funny is that if people did that here, they would be called terrorists, driving trucks into crowds of civilians at full speed. There, they were heroes. They were heroes defecting from Maduro's army. So that was the first thing that happened. And then the second thing that happened that you guys probably saw if you were tuned into the media was that, quote unquote, the regime burnt the aid trucks, that the aid trucks were set on fire by Maduro and his forces. Well, if you look at an aerial shot of the bridge that these aid trucks were on, they didn't even get close to the Venezuelan side. They were actually just surrounded by these quite guarimeros toward the Colombian side. Again, masked militant wings of the opposition protesters who were making Molotov cocktails in a literal factory over there. Like, even Bloomberg caught this on camera, and they're like, oh, there's a Molotov cocktail factory. And you can see footage of one of the guarimeros throwing the Molotov cocktail, and the aid truck explodes. So this was just repeated ad nauseum with zero question whatsoever. The regime lit the aid trucks on fire. What are we going to do about it? That's how crazy these people are. They're burning the aid. I mean, it was just nuts. It's just absolutely insane. Zero evidence. Zero, zero evidence. And then so when this didn't work either, right? So this didn't work. This human chain that they said was going to barge into Venezuela and feed the people, feed the starving masses. There was barely anyone there except these kind of militant protesters at the end of the day. No real protesters, no starving masses, no one who was just really legitimate trying to do this stunt alongside with these US proxies and people like Marco Rubio. So they were so desperate at that point that Marco Rubio just went on some bizarre, unhinged Twitter rant. I don't know if you guys saw this, where he literally posted snuff photos of Muammar Gaddafi in an open threat to Maduro. Literally, like, posted murder shots of Gaddafi getting raped with a sword and murdered in the streets. And I found that reprehensible. We actually started a petition to try to call for his resignation just as a symbolic gesture, because the fact that Ilhan Omar gets widespread condemnation for simply talking about a lobbying force on the Hill. It's all about the Benjamins, baby. This is how AIPAC works. Oh, no. No, 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 no. You're going to get condemned from not only Republicans, not only the entirety of the mainstream media, but your own allies, Democrats. Everyone's going to come down on you and demand an apology or a clarification. Where was the outrage about Marco Rubio threatening to murder a leader? He threatened to murder Nicolas Maduro. Twitter didn't even remove the photos. They didn't censor him at all. There was nothing at all. And in fact, if you looked at the mainstream media the next day, it was like, oh, cryptic tweet sends the world ablaze. Like, what did he mean by this? It's like, I don't know. I think he was calling to murder Maduro. That's what I think the tweet meant. He also posted photos of Manuel Noriega getting arrested. I mean, look, everyone remembers what happened in Panama. Operation Just Cause. 3,000 Panamanians died in that. He's threatening that. And then he went and threatened the Cuban president. We'll see you next. This man is a lunatic. This man is a lunatic. He should immediately resign from Congress. But there's not one peep, not one peep, even from these so-called progressives. Where is the outrage? Where is the outrage? So I just couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it. It made me physically ill. Physically ill to see that. So, like I said, I mean, these people are legitimizing the mechanism for regime change now. Like, Elizabeth Warren. She's someone that Trump humiliates every time she's given airtime, every time he's given airtime talking about her, he humiliates her. Yet you would think that someone like her would say, yeah, Trump's disgusting. Obviously, this is a cynical ploy. Even if she were to couch her language in, oh, Maduro needs aid, you would think that she would at least be like, but we can't trust Trump, obviously. But no, she went out there and said, yeah, we need to support this. So it's just very surreal, isn't it? It's kind of revealing that there really is some sort of deep state apparatus that supersedes the partisan politics. And whenever there's kind of this opportunity that arises of a neoconservative regime change plot that has been in the works for decades, everyone lines up in uniformity to make that happen. And it doesn't matter what else is going on, that will happen. And we're seeing it unfold right before our eyes. So again, Maduro is receiving aid. He's receiving aid from countries that are not trying to actively overthrow him. That's the difference. So Bernie Sanders had a town hall. Two of the questions, this shows you how insane our corporate media is. Two of the questions at the town hall were about why won't he call Maduro a dictator? Two questions. Can you imagine? At a town hall about being, you know, becoming president with dire issues in this country, failures, complete failures And he had to like be put on the spot twice. And it wasn't just that, the next day after this town hall, that's all they talked about on CNN. Why didn't he call Maduro a dictator? Well, he's not fit to be president. He should have said Maduro was a dictator. Can you believe that this is the discourse in this country? It was just nuts. So, you know, this isn't just happening, of course, in the big six or maybe even big five now, with the five corporations controlling basically everything that we see, hear, and read. It's the information war, like I said, coup by tweet. It's happening in the social media sphere, and it's unfolding real time on Twitter and on social media.
How could this be the land of the free, home of the brave, indigenous Holocaust, and the home of the slaves? Corporate America dancing offbeat to the rhythm. You really think this country never sponsored terrorism? Human rights violations, we continue the saga. El Salvador and the Contras and Nicaragua. And on top of that, you still want to take me to prison just because I won't trade humanity for patriotism. It's like MK Ultra controlling your brains.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm the host, Mickey Huff. We'd like to now share with you the conclusion of Abby Martin's speech, Critical Media Challenging U.S. Empire.
Generality, fighting for freedom and fighting terror, but what's reality? Read about the history of the place that we live in, and stop letting corporate news tell lies to your children. Flow like the blood of Abraham through the Jews and the Arabs, broken apart like a woman's heart, abused in the marriage, the brink of holy war, bottled up like a miscarriage. Embedded correspondents don't tell the source of the tension, and they refuse to even mention European intervention.
So whatever we see online, first of all, it's so dominated by right-wing exiles and pro-coup Venezuelans that it's really hard to like kind of sort through that. But you have to understand, in a corporate media structure that's subsidized by big oil, and when Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, you have to also ask yourself, it's not just the NSA, it's not just Russian bots, right? What are corporations doing to employ their own propaganda operations to correct the record themselves? We know from back during the BP oil spill that Darjamal, I think, found out that BP was employing bots, hundreds of bots, to just confuse people online, to take people down who were trying to fight BP. So you have to kind of imagine, right, that that is happening on such a grand scale that we can't even comprehend, while everything is being deflected toward Russian bots and fake news. What are corporations doing? What is the NSA doing? What is the US government doing to shape these narratives online? And also, what's real? What is real and what's not? So tens of millions of dollars are going into these social media operations to steer this line and to embolden the corporate media narrative. Twitter just removed 2,000 pro-Maduro accounts based on no evidence at all that they had anything to do with the government. They said that they were, quote, influencing people. So, you know, under the banner of fighting fake news and Russian propaganda, there's been a massive purge of alternative voices, of grassroots news. And it pretty much started to happen after the 2016 election. Under the banner of fighting fake news and Russian disinfo, that all became one and the same to the blob in DC. That all became the same. So this traumatic election just made them, basically gave them an opportunity to crack down on dissent and to crack down on anti-establishment voices online. In 2017, the Senate Judiciary Committee made a request to Facebook, Google, and Twitter, Google owns YouTube, remember, to draw up a mission statement to prevent the foment of discord. Now, discord literally means disagreement. That's what it means. So the government asked these tech companies, and there was no law mandating them to do so. They preemptively did this. They acquiesced to the U.S. government without a law. They changed all the algorithms. They backpaged all news like Project Censored, like Counterpunch, like Empire Files. You can't even find our stuff if you type it on YouTube, unless you go directly to our channel. But that's what they've done. That's what they've done under the banner of fighting Russian disinformation and fake news. They don't care about fighting fake. They are fake news. I mean, the corporate media is the best example of fake news. But if you criticize the U.S. in any way, you're fomenting discord, you're fomenting radical discontent, and you're a useful idiot for the Kremlin. For example, the New York Times, during this coup attempt, the New York Times said, Russia alleges that this is a coup. Russia alleges that this is a coup. So that's a Russian talking point, that this is a coup. Like, that's how far gone we are. And of course, if you know anything about the New York Times, you know they've supported every coup in history. So that's not surprising. But now it's a Russian talking point. Reality is a Russian talking point. And let's talk about state media really quick, because state media, like Telesur, like Russia Today, are bemoaned as state propaganda organs, discredited, right? Cartoonishly going along with who's an enemy and who's a friend of the U.S. government. Well, their state agencies are now enemies and friends of us. So Al Jazeera is now accepted. It used to be called the terrorist network during 9/11. Now that's credible in the eyes of the mainstream. BBC, France 24, they're fine. RT, Telesur, bad. Bad. Well, I think we're mature enough to get the Russian perspective. I want the Russian perspective. I want the Chinese perspective. I want the Middle Eastern perspective. I don't want to look at the world through an ethnocentrist, jingoistic, nationalist lens, especially when we're the world's largest empire that's dominating the rest of the world, subjugating billions of people under our boot. So yeah, I think that we're mature enough to not have our reality curated for us by these tech giants. The fascinating thing about this whole argument, corporate versus state media, is that there's obviously way more freedom at agencies like Telesur and RT. I mean, that's pretty obvious, because you look at the corporate media, I think that people like Phil Donahue and Chris Hedges, even, who opposed the Iraq War. I mean, Chris Hedges lost his job at the New York Times. Phil Donahue lost his job at MSNBC. They've been vindicated, right? The Iraq War, biggest crime of the century, million plus Iraqis dead, destabilized an entire region. They were vindicated, yet they were fired and punished. The people who sold us the war, the neoconservatives, the Iraq War architects, they were rewarded. They're back, baby. They're back with a vengeance. They've never been bigger. Bill Kristol has never been more famous and popular. It's pretty amazing. So the corporate media rewards the propagandists. They reward the war criminals, right? Again, subsidized by defense contractors. That's why you see commercials for Boeing and Lockheed Martin when you're just like eating dinner. I mean, we're not buying tanks, so what the f*** is that? So, I mean, it's just such an obvious reflection of who owns the state. You know, why does the corporate media echo the Pentagon? Why? It's not state media. It's not state run. Well, it's a corporate state. It's an oligarchic corporate state. And the interests of those corporations are reflected in the government, right? And that's what the government exists to do. They represent the 1%. They're there to protect and serve the capitalist class, the 0.1%. They're friends and buddies. I mean, I lived in D.C. for years. I know how it is. It's all about access. It's all about access. People are not paid to lie. People join these organizations because they're the, quote, right-thinking journalists. They are groomed and institutionalized in these elite universities and journalism schools, and then they go into these institutions thinking, believing in American exceptionalism. They believe in this stuff. And so they call me an activist journalist as if that's like a demeaning slur. But the thing is, they're activist journalists. They're activists on behalf of the U.S. empire. They do activism to protect the corporate line. That's the difference. I think that even during the Iraq War, like I introduced this talking about, is that there seemed to even be more diversity during the Iraq War. And I think that it's been consolidated ever more. It's becoming worse every year, and it's reflected in the state of journalism. It's never been more dire. And again, not just the media, but of course in Congress as well, there is no difference of opinion, right? The critique for Trump is coming from the right. It's the critique from the war machine. It's the critique from the generals. Even in Congress, with as much diversity, you know, we all hear about how Congress is the most diverse in history. Well, you really can't find a diversity in opinion about the U.S. war machine, about empire, about ending the 800 bases around the world. Why? Why is that? Simply put, none of this would be able to happen without the media. The U.S. empire is flailing, especially with someone as obtuse as Trump. It is losing its footing, at least its trust in the rest of the world. I'm not looking forward to seeing what the U.S. empire is going to do when it is dying and in the death throes, but none of this would be able to happen so far without the media. Without the media apparatus that paints itself as free. It's constructed and manufactured consent for every single regime change operation, and it will continue to do so. And because of this uniformity and lockstep narrative, even the left, progressive outlets, are so wishy-washy on Venezuela. They're all taking this fake middle ground that literally does not exist. If you talk to Venezuelans in the street, no one's gonna say, oh, I don't know. I mean, Maduro's a bad guy, but people are like, we don't want the US here. We will die for the revolution, or, you know, Maduro's a dictator, we'll die for the revolution. That's what it is. That's why a civil war is possible. It is a very stark reality, because that's how divided the country is. So for leftists and people to kind of sit on their ivory towers here and to say, oh, Maduro should have done this, you should have done that, that's not how Venezuelans are thinking. So it's pretty gross to kind of pontificate or be on the record pathologizing the evilness of Maduro before you need to denounce regime change. Don't fall into that game. Okay, they do this every time to us, where you first need to denounce Saddam, you need to denounce Maduro, before you can denounce the US government's economic war that's killing people. We're American citizens, that's our duty. If we can't do that, then what good are we? So sadly, civil war is not the worst possible scenario in Venezuela. Sadly, a US military intervention, a Just Cause 2.0, is the worst possible scenario here. And guess what? It's very likely to happen. Trump is a madman, he's a monster, and his ego is so out of control that I actually can't see him backing down here. Someone asked him, you know, because he's sitting down with Kim Jong-un, why can't you sit down with Maduro? He said it's too far along. The regime change is too far along. We can't back down now. What does that mean? That's why it is so, so crucial for us to be active players, to be involved, to combat the information war, because that's what this is. It is now in the internet. It's online. The war is being waged on our minds. It is an information war, as we know. I mean, it's never been more apparent with the onslaught of propaganda coming from Venezuela. And so we need to be both online and in the streets. It's about time that we build up an actual resistance to the war machine, a genuine anti-war movement, galvanize efforts to combat this, and to force the Progressive Caucus to address this. We need to force their hand. People say I'm being too hard on AOC and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. No, if we're not hard on them, who will be? We need to fight them from the left. We need to force them to admit, yes, we shouldn't have this empire. We shouldn't have these bases. This is where our money's going. We're squandering it all. So this is why the work of Project Censored, what you guys are all involved in, the fact that you guys are even here, that you're involved in activism, is so crucial. The work of independent journalists, independent media, like Project Censored, like Empire Files, are so crucial to support and follow and get involved with. Be a part of this. It's enlightening. It's a beautiful thing. It's the only thing that really gives me hope, frankly, to link up with like minds and to understand that we are doing what we can do on a daily basis to combat this. And it is working, by the way. I meet people every day who say, because of your work on Venezuela, now I understand it. I mean, it gets out there, and we are doing our part as much as we can, and we all need to be a part of this. But it is daunting, right? I mean, the corporate media control, the consolidation, the tech censorship, it's very daunting. But it's a sign of how much grassroots efforts have been able to build up. They've been threatening the hell out of the establishment. And that's why they're doing this, obviously. They know how much of a threat we are. And with the internet, with this egalitarian notion that you can be just as big as CNN, you can combat these narratives and reach the same audience levels. That's what scares the hell out of them. That's why they're locking it down. But we just need to keep going. We need to keep going. Everyone here is involved in doing something very important. Media literacy, social justice work. It's the most critical time for the future of our planet. And with people like you, we are all truly, truly trying to combat, while we're in this regressive, abysmal dystopia, we are all trying to push forward and create progress and create change. And we are active in fighting on the front lines, because this is a war for truth. It is a war for truth. And no matter how much they want us to feel alone and isolated in our beliefs and activism, tens of millions stand shoulder to shoulder to us, with us. The truth will prevail. And the more we lift each other up and embolden that truth, the weaker the U.S. empire will become. Thanks so much, you guys. And if anyone has any questions, yeah.
What are your thoughts on Tulsi Gabbard's campaign?
Thank you for bringing her up, because she is the only, she's pretty much the only one that's not couching her rhetoric in like, Maduro is evil, but we shouldn't intervene. She's actually saying we should not intervene. This is outrageous. The neoconservatives and neoliberals are fomenting this, and it's completely crazy. And I really respect her and appreciate her for that a lot. I would love to hear her clarify her stance on torture and Israel, considering she was at AIPAC 2 years ago. But I think that right now she's definitely the best that we have on the campaign trail to combat the coup and regime change wars. And I am so excited that she'll be out there on the debate stage really pushing that dialogue to the left. That's super crucial right now. Yeah, so I'm really happy she's out there, and I hope she really keeps them on their toes. But yeah, she's getting, it's amazing to see how smeared she's getting for simply just saying she didn't want war in Syria. You Assadist! Why do you love Assad? Like, why do you love Assad, Tulsi? I mean, it's just, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, what do you think we should be doing about the closing down of the open society that we see in these changes to the Google algorithms and Facebook, shutting down pages and what seems to be their own filtering of certain posts that have certain links. That seems like just an incredibly dangerous thing that we have to confront.
It is very dangerous, and it's affected a ton of people and really had a lot of good organizations take a hit. And a lot of people have lost a lot of funding structures. And I think that the absolute best thing that we can do is join mailing lists. Directly follow the journalists and organizations that you wish to see. We have to go back to before social media, before we bought in and invested so much of our time and energy, because it really can be shut down in a heartbeat.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I am Mickey Huff, the executive producer and host of the program, along with Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on roughly 50 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about the work, to find any of our previous archived programs, please go to projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time.
Habitualized, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes while the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Times running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.